All right, here we go. Didactic Mind, episode 19. The CoronaChan post. And very warm welcome, as always, to all of my listeners, my loyal readers from the blog, my SoundCloud subscribers. Very happy to be with you all once again. So the point of today's post is, or today's podcast, is to discuss the coronavirus outbreak. Now, I've addressed this in a couple posts already, and I think it's high time I return to it in a perhaps a less dramatic fashion, because there is an awful lot of what you might call fear, uncertainty, and doubt surrounding the coronavirus right now. And it might be worth taking a little bit of time to explore it all and understand what's going on and give you some personal anecdotes about whether or not this can be contained, whether it can amount to anything good in the long run, what's going to come out of it, because there's a lot to unpack here with this story. There's a whole lot going on with the coronavirus outbreak around the world, and it's obviously a very scary time for a lot of people. But it's also, I think, in my honest opinion, unnecessarily amped up and amplified in ways that are highly counterproductive. So, at the time this was recorded, I recorded this podcast before, sometime before it actually got uploaded, so it was saved down as a file because I had some spare time. It was useful to go in and look at the total number of infections. There's a website which I think is based on Johns Hopkins University data. And it's a kind of a live update almost, or a day-by-day update from the Johns Hopkins CSSE, something, I forget what exactly that's called. But it's a Johns Hopkins interactive database, and it's got a map of the world on it where you can see all the clustering of coronavirus cases. And I'll provide a link to that map to you in the links in the description box. And it's worth taking a look at simply because you'll see very quickly which parts of the world are affected by the coronavirus outbreak and which ones are not. And if you look at that data set, it's really very illuminating. What you're going to see very quickly is just how concentrated the coronavirus outbreaks really are. At the time of recording this podcast, there have been a total of 100,330 confirmed cases of coronavirus, of COVID-19. COVID-19, of course, is the categorization or the name given to this latest novel coronavirus, as it's been called. It is apparently related to SARS, and it has definitely reached epidemic proportions. I mean, when you have 100,000 people across the world infected with the same disease, it's an epidemic. No question, no doubt about that. Okay? That being said, the numbers that you see in the headlines always consist of number of infected and the number of deaths. Now, the total number of infected is, as I said, at the time of this recording, 100,330. The total number of deaths is 3,408. The one statistic that you're not seeing, and the statistic that is probably the most important out of all of these, is the total number of recovered. The total number of recovered, as of the time of this recording, is 55,694. So over 55% of cases have recovered. Only about 3.5% of cases result in death. Of those deaths, the overwhelming majority are in China. 2,931 deaths in China, mainland China, particularly in Hubei province. 148 deaths in Italy, 124 in Iran, 42 in South Korea, 22 in Henan province, 13 in Heilongjiang, 12 deaths in King County, Washington, 8 deaths in Beijing, mainland China, 7 in France, 7 in Guangdong, 6 in Japan, 6 in Anhui, six in Chongqing, Chongqing, I guess is the correct name, six in Hainan, six in Hebei, six in Shandong, and six deaths aboard the Diamond Princess cruise ship. Here's the thing. If you break down those totals by region, what you're very quickly going to discover is that the mortality rate is already very low. It's only about 3.5% mortality rate. And or actually less, about 3.3% mortality rate. And more importantly than that, if you go by the regional totals, the mortality rates are significantly lower than what you might expect. If you look at the total number of deaths in South Korea, there are 6,600 odd cases, confirmed cases of coronavirus, of COVID-19 in South Korea as of right now, 42 deaths. There are 3,858 cases in Italy, 148 deaths. Now, if you do a little mathematics, you'll very quickly realize that in South Korea's case, the mortality rate is less than 1%. If you look at Italy, it's about 3%, roughly speaking. If you look at China, it's about 5%. No, hang on. 805. It's even less than that, actually. It's the mortality rate in China is about 3% total overall. And if you go, you know, country by country, region by region, to places where there have been deaths, if you look at France, for instance, 423 confirmed cases, but only 7 deaths. So the total number of deaths divided by the total number of cases indicates or total number of infected, indicates a mortality rate of between 2 and 4%, depending on where you are. So, based on this information alone, should you be worried? Well, maybe. I mean, a 2 to 4% chance of death is pretty high, relatively speaking. So now you need to break down the numbers a little bit further. You need to look at the age of the people. You need to look at the gender. You need to look at whether or not these people have pre-existing health conditions. And very quickly, patterns emerge that make it very clear that a whole bunch of the kind of miasma surrounding this disease is really pure fear, uncertainty, and doubt. It's FUD. If you are, as it happens, above the age of 70 and male and East Asian in ethnic origin and have a history of heart complications, yeah, you're in trouble. This disease is dangerous to you. I mean, genuinely dangerous. It's much more likely to kill you than anybody else who is infected. If, however, you don't meet those criteria, you're probably not even going to show symptoms. Quite a large percentage of the patients who have been diagnosed with COVID-19 show no symptoms whatsoever. They don't even know they have the disease, because their immune systems are strong enough to repress it, to deal with it and kill it before it causes them any serious problems. Many of the patients feel no worse than they would with a particularly bad flu, which is still very unpleasant. I mean, last time I had a really bad flu was, probably November of 2014, and I felt like I'd been hit by a truck and I had to stay home from work for 2 days. Just completely out of my mind on painkillers and decongestions because I was so exhausted and so sick. But I recovered within a week. I was fully back to normal. COVID-19, if you get infected and you show symptoms, you show frank symptoms, and you start feeling like the way that a lot of these patients who get serious COVID-19 do feel, then you're going to feel like your eyes are on fire, you can't breathe properly, you're itchy, you're unable to sleep. There's an interesting article in the Daily Mail, in various places, about what it's like to get this stuff. And it is a very unpleasant disease. But is it really worth panicking over? No, it's not. There are much worse things in life to get. If you look at what it, again, if you look at what it feels like to have this awful, nasty, disgusting, horrible disease, it's very, very unpleasant, obviously. I mean, as I said, you know, there's a link here from the Straits Times, from the New Straits Times, rather, which I believe is a Taiwanese newspaper. And it talks about what it feels like. And he says that once his condition deteriorated, he was constantly coughing. He said, I was coughing like I was going to die. At the hospital, multiple CT scans showed it was highly likely Taiwanese, I believe. Multiple CT scans showed that it was highly likely Ye had contracted COVID-19 and that it had spread to his lungs. Doctors deliberated if he qualified for a nucleic acid test, which would use the virus's genetic sequence to confirm if he had been infected, but it was decided his case wasn't severe enough, and the precious supply of test kits had to be reserved for more critical patients. Okay, so, yes, this is a very unpleasant disease. The guy who got this and showed really bad symptoms said his temperature soared to 39 degrees Celsius, about 102 degrees Fahrenheit, and doctors put him on an IV and administered Caletra, which is an antiretroviral drug used in AIDS and other immunodeficiency diseases. And finally, his condition, you know, after a week after the symptoms first began, he appeared to reach a turning point, and he started steadily improving. So the nature of the virus is that if you are young, healthy, have a robust immune system, you're probably going to recover within a week, assuming you get to the stage of having frank symptoms. And that's you know, a fairly big assumption. But if you do get to that stage, you're most likely to pull out of it after 1 week, maybe two. The danger of COVID-19 does not appear to be the first infection. The danger is the second infection. Here's why. Apparently, COVID-19 has a very short lifespan in the body's immune system, and the body basically kind of forgets how to fight this disease very quickly because it forgets the nucleic acid and protein signatures necessary to figure out what's going on with this, to identify this particular virus, and therefore to send out antibodies to kill it. Because of that, if you get infected a second time, shortly after you finish fighting off the first disease, then it's much more serious because now COVID-19 has a way to infiltrate all of your bodily systems, particularly your lungs, and start shutting them down by infecting them, destroying the cells, and your body will essentially try to fight that disease by drowning it. You know, your lungs will start to fill up with fluid, and you'll end up choking to death. You know, this is what happens in a handful of very, very severe cases. So, once again, is this something to be worried about? Is this something to panic about? Answer is no and no. If you are, again, below the age of 70, if you are not East Asian in origin, in ethnicity, if your race is, let's say, white or Hispanic or South Asian or black or whatever, non-East Asian races tend to do pretty well against this disease. For some reason, this virus tends to attach much more closely to East Asian people because of certain, I think, binding sites that East Asians have relative to non-East Asians. And it's not racist to state that. That's just, it seems to be where the evidence is pointing. People who think that's racist, I would say, really, get a life. It's not racist to state the obvious, okay? So, with that in mind, what is it like to be in the midst of a serious, massive epidemic? Well, to put things into perspective, this disease is nowhere near as lethal, actually, as an annual flu. Now, if you look up the statistics of a really bad flu season, such as 2017 to 18, between several, you know, like, what is 18 million Americans? That's 18 million Americans were infected with the flu that year, roughly speaking. That's a very, very rough number. That's an estimate. The 2017 to 18 flu season was very, very bad. It's considered historically one of the worst flu seasons in living memory. Of those roughly 18 million people, about 70 to 80,000 of them died. The overwhelming majority of those deaths were elderly people. There were a few young children who died. God rest their souls. I'm really sorry about that. It's really sad, particularly when a young person dies of the flu. The majority of those deaths were, let's face facts, old people. And again, I'm not happy about that fact. It is a great tragedy when an old person dies of the flu. But at the same time, it's also kind of expected. You can't expect elderly people to have the same immune systems and robust defenses that someone in his 20s to 50s will have. It's not possible. It's very difficult for someone in his 70s, 80s, or 90s to have the kind of robust immune system that somebody 20, 30, 40 years younger will have. So, that is the annual death toll from a really bad flu. Again, 70 to 80,000 dead. 70 to 80,000 people in China alone have been infected with the disease. Of those, as the numbers point out, 42,000 have recovered. Okay? So remember to put this into perspective. We don't consider the flu to be a massive threat to world stability, peace, and economic output, because it's not. Coronavirus 19 is not going to bring about the end of the world. Those people who have been running around saying, the end is nigh, this is a sign of the biblical apocalypse, the sign of the mark of the beast is upon us. Guys, seriously, just chill. You're full of crap. That's not the case. There will come a reckoning one day. I don't know about the rapture. As far as I can tell, it's extra biblical, but I don't concern myself much with such things. The nature of this disease does not lend itself to such panic. If this were an outbreak of Ebola, which had suddenly turned even more highly contagious than it already is, then, yeah, we'd be looking at the end times. If this were an outbreak of H5N1, absolutely, we'd be looking at the end times. To put things into perspective, I mean, H5N1 is the scientific designation for avian flu, bird flu. H1N1 is regular human flu. H5N1 is extraordinarily dangerous. H5N1 is avian flu, and it infects chickens and birds primarily as a form of stomach flu. So if you've ever had stomach flu, it's an absolutely horrendous experience. Essentially, your stomach simply is unable to, your intestinal lining and your stomach is just simply unable to process food. You end up just shitting out water, and it's absolutely disgusting, absolutely horrifying. It takes about 3 days to 1 week to get past, and you lose enormous amounts of weight in the process. You can potentially die of dehydration. Birds will die in their hundreds of thousands and millions from this disease. Avian flu is genuinely very dangerous. What the reason why avian flu is dangerous, to humans is because H5N1 attacks specific amino acid binding sites in the gut of a bird. Very similar binding sites are to be found in the lungs of humans. They're not the same, they're similar. If they were the same binding sites, then H5N1 would be able to jump from birds to humans without any problems whatsoever. That would be a world killer. Why? Because the last time there was a serious outbreak of H5N1, the mortality rate recorded in China was 60%. 60%. You have a 2 in 3 chance, if you get this stuff, of dying from it. Even the stupidest gambler in Vegas wouldn't take those odds. 60% chance of dying, you're boned if you catch this disease. It's genuinely well and truly horrific. You are more likely to die from this disease than recover from it. And if that had started spreading around the world, 2/3 of the world's population would be dead in a matter of months. That's a truly world-killing pandemic. Just to put things into perspective, that's what it would take. Okay? Now, what would a world like that look like? Well, it would look like a world completely coming apart at the seams. I mean, I expect that when H5N1, not if, but when H5N1 becomes human transmissible, it will originate in China, because that seems to be what tends to happen. Really horrific diseases tend to come from countries with autocratic regimes and extremely pathetic, you know, public health systems, really terrible ways of suppressing information and stopping people from dealing with crises, and a real desire from the top not to know what's going on. That's China down to a T, but it also describes Africa perfectly. Either it's going to happen in China or in Africa, and that's where the two really terrible threats to humanity have come from. H5N1, there was an outbreak in China about 20 years ago, maybe more. A bunch of poultry workers caught H5N1, and the reason they caught it was because they breathed in the viral loads from the feces of birds that were infected with this stuff. And because they breathed in that stuff, the viri managed to latch onto the binding sites in their lungs, and they basically died choking on their own fluids in the process. 60% mortality rate, remember. And if it's not the original virus that kills you, it will be the secondary infections that follow it up. The secondary infections that get into your lungs when they're weakened and infect you from within, such as bacterial or viral pneumonia. That is what will genuinely kill you. It will genuinely destroy your immune system and will just wipe you out. And it will wipe out many, many millions of people if this ever happens. It is a genuinely horrifying thing to think about. I know that. I mean, I don't want to scare anyone into worrying unnecessarily, but this is the reality that we need to prepare for, is a scenario where a world-killing plague such as H5N1 is released. Again, I want to ram this point home. COVID-19 is not a world killer. COVID-19 is no worse than a bad flu for most people. Not for everybody, for most people. There were 700-odd people on that Diamond Princess or whatever it was, cruise ship, that were infected with COVID-19. Okay? Of those people, of those however many were infected, where's that statistic? Yeah, Diamond Princess, 6 deaths out of 700 people. 1%. That's it. There's a Harvard epidemiologist who has been arguing kind of the same thing. I've got the link somewhere on my phone, and I will provide it, I think, in the description box as well, where he basically says, look, guys, everybody chill out a little bit. This is not quite as scary as people think it is. So, having, I hope, maybe reassured you a little bit that COVID-19 is not quite the apocalyptic doomsday scenario that we all think it is, let me take a moment to explore what it really is, and what is the most effective way to respond to it. I was there, as I wrote in one of my blog posts about this this very subject some months ago, about 2 months ago now. COVID-19 is very much reminiscent of the SARS crisis of 2003, when another coronavirus, to which COVID-19 is closely related apparently, broke out of China and made its way around the world very, very quickly. At that time, there were some, I think, a couple of thousand infected cases and how many deaths? There were, I think, 300-odd deaths in... There were several hundred deaths in China, 774 deaths in total, and the majority of the deaths were in Hong Kong. SARS broke out in southern China in between November 2002 and July 2003, resulted in 8,096 cases and 774 deaths reported in multiple countries, with a roughly 9.6% fatality rate. 9.6% fatality is much higher. It's at least three times higher than the current mortality rate for COVID-19. This is nowhere near as serious or dangerous a virus as SARS was. SARS was genuinely a very, very scary threat. Now, how did the world respond to that? Well, I was there in Singapore when it happened. And it was a very scary time because Singapore basically implemented completely draconian protocols. This was the right thing to do. Before anyone asks whether it's okay or a good idea to shut down flights and transportation, let's be very clear. The only way to respond to a global pandemic is to shut everything down. That's it. For those of you who have not read John Ringo's The Last Centurion, highly recommend it. It's a fantastic book. It touches on a huge range of subjects. I've recommended it many times before. And one of the things that John Ringo talks about in The Last Centurion is an outbreak of H5N1 and how to combat it properly. Now, in the book, he discusses a game called Othello, which is essentially a game that involves surrounding the enemy player with sort of colored like marbles or rocks, essentially. And if you can skip over one of the rocks, then the rock, which is painted on both sides, changes color. So you go from a white pebble to a black pebble, basically. So if you have a white pebble and a black pebble skips over it, then the original white pebble turns into a black pebble. Okay. The idea is to surround the white player with all black, or the black player with all white. Okay. That's how disease control works. If you find one person who is infected, you then find everyone that he was in contact with from the time that you think he got infected. You find everyone who those people were in contact with from that time that they were in contact with him. You find everyone that those people were in contact with. It's an exponentially growing curve. So let's say you have one guy who's infected. He shakes hands with 20 other people in the space of a week. Or he is in close proximity with 20 other people. You have to go find those 20 other people, and then those people will meet 20-odd other people. So then those people will go find 20-odd people. So you go from 1 to 20 to 400 to 8,000. Okay? So it's growing exponentially. It's growing by a power law, more or less. And in order to get ahead of this little sucker, you have to then quarantine those 8,000 people. You have to simply isolate them, keep them under quarantine, make sure that they never get out. And this is a hugely expensive nightmare of a task. But that's exactly what Singapore did. That's exactly what many of the countries that got clear of SARS did immediately. They implemented extraordinarily drastic quarantine measures. And they basically were able to get rid of that virus within the space of about 6 months. Now, those 6 months were absolutely brutal for the Singaporean economy. I mean, it destroyed the Singaporean economy for the space of about 2 quarters. Singapore's economy shrank by, I think, 1%, maybe more that year. The economic consequences were absolutely devastating, particularly for an open, trade-driven economy like Singapore. I was there. I saw, you know, accountants and banking professionals turn into taxi drivers, maids, hawker center sellers overnight. I mean, they lost their jobs, they lost everything because the economy contracted so sharply. But the disease was wiped out, and Singapore saw very little genuine disturbance from it. It was a terrible time, but the containment measures worked. What has become absolutely evident from the outbreak of SARS and a follow-up disease called MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, also known as camel flu, which is a kind of a, apparently a related coronavirus, is that MERS and SARS are genuinely quite dangerous, and MERS is much more dangerous. I mean, MERS has a 40% mortality rate. There were 1,000 cases reported as of May 2015, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. That had a 40% mortality rate, so 400 people died from this. And it is a... MERS-CoV is derived from bats. So basically, the way it happened was, you know, infected bats bit camels, camels infected humans in the process, and it, you know, humans just died in their hundreds from this disease. Thank God that didn't spread, because a 40% mortality rate disease would be a true plague. Again, my intention here is not to scare people listening. The intention is to educate you and to show you that this coronavirus is nowhere near as bad as it could be. The standard by which all plagues are judged, which is the Spanish flu of 1918 to 1919, killed tens of, well, nobody quite knows the number, but let's go look it up. The total number of dead from the Spanish flu was about 50 to 100 million dead at the time. 1918 flu pandemic, 50 to 100 million dead. And that is what, after it infected 500 million people. So that had a 10 to 20% mortality rate. It had a 10 to 20% mortality rate. Yeah. That is what a true plague looks like. Something that has over 10% mortality rate, spreads to tens of millions of people, and results in tens of millions of deaths. That's a true plague. You go all the way back to the 14th century, and you look at the Black Death, the bubonic plague that spread throughout Europe. Again, tens of millions of deaths. Now, what do these potential world-killing plagues have in common? Well, they tend to spread at times of tremendous economic and political and social dislocation. The 1918 flu pandemic spread as far as it did because millions and millions of people around the world had their psychological and physiological defenses greatly lowered. The horrors of World War I wrought untold damage upon millions of people, and the disease pits that were the trenches of the Great War spread misery and death at a rate that we've not seen before, and it spread that death around the world. The world's entire immune system was lowered as a result of that horror. If you look at the bubonic plague and the way that that spread, the Black Death spread because fleas that were infected with the plague bit rats, which spread around the world, and bit humans. Now, why did the rats get a chance to spread? Because sewage systems and public waste disposal in the Middle Ages were just awful. I mean, to get an idea of just how bad it was in a modern context, you have to go to a real shithole country like India, and look at what public sewage systems are like there. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in those countries, and it's absolutely horrifying. You'll find just open sewers everywhere, filth, and just still water, clogged up water, sitting in there. Perfect breeding ground for mosquitoes. You know, people shitting in the streets, people allowing dogs to breathe unchecked, people not doing the necessary work to maintain sanitation, to maintain civilization, to maintain plumbing. That's what it's like in the dirt world. And that is a perfect breeding ground for a lot of diseases. This is not normal in the Western world, but it is normal in the dirt world. And that's the thing that people have a hard time understanding, is that these killer diseases really only thrive in countries where, and in societies where, public hygiene is not regarded as a significant priority. That's the thing to remember when looking at this novel coronavirus, COVID-19. It is spreading to its maximum extent in countries that, number one, have very poor public health systems. Number two, have extremely poor public sanitation. Number three, have a number of environmental factors that result in lowered immunity, because the immune system is constantly fighting an uphill battle to just deal with environmental factors. Think about how polluted Chinese cities are, and you get an idea of what I mean. I visited Beijing in, October of 2001, and within 2 days of setting foot in Beijing, which is covered in a very thick layer of smog, both my dad and I came down with horrible sore throats. It was just appalling. I mean, it was just like you couldn't swallow. And we couldn't really go to a doctor there, so we had to get like herbal remedies to deal with the soreness and the swelling. And it was only after we left Beijing and went to Xi'an, which is a much smaller city, it's a much more historical city, that we were finally able to get some relief from these symptoms, which were very painful and very miserable. So we were able to deal with the misery of the disease, but it took us some time to get to that point. That being said, if you look at China as a country overall, we can conclude that it's not a great place to fall sick. Its public healthcare is genuinely not the best, and the fact that these nasty, horrifying diseases keep coming out of China indicates that it's really not well prepared for an outbreak of something truly devastating, such as, God help us, human transmissible H5N1 avian flu. If that ever happens, I mean, run for the hills, because that will kill you, more likely than not. So, compared to what we've seen historically, COVID-19 is nowhere near as scary. Compared to what we've seen historically, the containment response has been pathetic. It is well beyond the level of containing and preventing COVID-19 from breaking out. It's already reached that point. COVID-19 has already broken out. COVID-19 has already reached places like Russia. I mean, in Moscow, for instance, just the other day, 700 students were quarantined at a Russian university in Moscow because somebody came back from Italy, I believe. And let me see if I can go find the story here. It's around here somewhere. Somebody came back from a trip to Italy and tested positive for the virus. So now 700 people in that environment have to be quarantined. That, again, is what it takes. That's about what it takes to contain a threat like that. But is it effective? Well, not really. Not right now, it isn't. Here's the story. It's basically returnees, somebody came back from Italy and basically got quarantined for, for testing after testing positive, and now Russia has shut down travel from China. Like anybody coming in, like flights from China have been barred. They shut down their border with China itself, the eastern border in Siberia with China a long time ago. They basically stopped rail travel. That's kind of how you have to respond to a disease like this. The response from the United States in particular has been, I think, fairly good. I mean, his most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of Mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, implemented very swift procedures to stop travelers from China coming in. And that was the right thing to do. He was absolutely right to do it. Now, he got crucified for doing it by the Democrats and by the mainstream media, which is basically the same thing at this point. But he was right to do it. This was the right course of action to follow. He did the right thing. A few weeks later, he instituted a task force designed to investigate the coronavirus and come up with public health emergency plans. And he got crucified for that by taking the response too slowly. It was like, well, first he overreacted and then he underreacted. Obviously, the God Emperor can't do anything right in the eyes of his critics, and that's their problem. In my opinion, that's the right way to do things. The right way to deal with this is indeed to shut down all travel from the epicenter of a serious outbreak, and to contain the outbreak to the maximum extent possible. Now, the disease is already more or less past the point of containment in a number of countries. In China, I mean, they have 500 million people under lockdown, more or less. In Italy, schools have been closed, government buildings have been shut down, public transport has been suspended. In France, it's looking like the same thing's going to happen. The UK's in a full-blown panic about it. They've got about 100 cases, I think, in the UK itself. And yet, nobody seems to be keeping things in perspective. Nobody seems to be thinking rationally about this. The reality is, this isn't a particularly dangerous outbreak. And panic buying and hoarding is only useful in the event that you find yourself quarantined. You're going to be really bored for 2 weeks while you're under quarantine. It's going to suck. You can't go out anywhere. You can't do anything. You're going to succumb to cabin fever very quickly. That's going to be miserable. In that situation, yes, it makes sense to have 2 weeks' worth of supplies at minimum, in terms of food and drinking water. And that's a good idea. You know, by all means, if you're going to be worried about this virus, sure, take some preventative measures. By all means, bathe yourself in hand sanitizer, wash your hands with soap, of course. Face masks aren't going to do you much good because they're not particularly effective, that much is very clear, because this disease can travel through the mucous membranes of the eyes. And the face masks themselves are not particularly effective unless they're actually filtering out all microbial agents. If you're going to really get worried, then, you know, good luck to you. Find yourself a bug-out bunker and take your survival kit with you. But honestly, the odds of you falling sick are very, very low. The odds of you dying are even lower. So don't panic about it. That's all I'm saying. Don't get yourself into a complete fluster about it. That being said, there are some very pointed lessons for us to learn about this disease. There are unquestionably some serious problems that have been exposed in the world's supply chain and the world's sort of vulnerabilities have been exposed in glaring fashion. The thing is that China is one of the world's major centers for pharmaceutical production. So a lot of the medicines that are critical to fighting this disease only come from China. Well, guess what? One-third of the Chinese economy is basically shut down. One-third of it is gone. And it's not going to get restarted for some weeks to months yet. It's going to take a long time for the Chinese to get back up to speed to manufacturing at the levels that they were. Their economy is going to take a massive hit from this. And one of the biggest lessons that we've learned from the coronavirus outbreak is that the world's supply lines are highly vulnerable. to massive disruptions of this kind. This has not been a pleasant lesson for anybody. This is a lesson to the entire world of the dangers of outsourcing your entire industrial base to a hostile power, particularly if you're the United States. The USA has outsourced its manufacturing base to a large extent and is now paying the price. The philosophy of just-in-time manufacturing is a great one. I'm not arguing against it. I don't think it's a bad idea. I think the Japanese were right about just-in-time processes and manufacturing. It's a great way to run a lean, cost-effective company. It's a great idea. Okay? But as with all things, every system, such as a big manufacturing system, can be made into a lean, mean, profitable machine until a massive tail event hits. And I'm speaking from the perspective of somebody who has a background in sort of mathematical finance and quantitative finance and understands what tail events really are. These are the extreme end of the probability distribution where you have extremely low probability events, you know, something that is supposed to happen only once in a billion years, which in reality happens much more frequently because these distributions are not well understood. And when they happen, they are extreme events. I mean, very low frequency, very high severity events. The problem is that nobody quite knows how to prepare for them because they're so extreme that the cost of preparing for them is unbelievably high. I mean, think about preparing for a tsunami, okay? What is the probability that you're going to die from a tsunami? It's tiny. It's infinitesimally small. But in 2004, on December 24th, 2004, there was a gigantic tsunami that originated in Aceh, which killed something like 250,000 people. That was a once-in-a-generation event, probably even more rare than that. And it happened simply because two tectonic plates slipped past each other and the subduction zone experienced a significant stress event that where there was a buckling of one continental plate under another, and you know, a point of significant friction suddenly gave way, and the result was a catastrophically bad earthquake which basically wiped out the town nearest the epicenter of the earthquake. I mean, that town was completely destroyed, but the damage that resulted after that came from the tsunami that spread across the entire Indian Ocean and large parts of the Pacific. Now, again, 250,000 people died in that tsunami, and I remember this very vividly because I was in Cochin at the time. All those many years ago, and I remember very vividly walking into my parents' room, where we were all clustered around the TV as a big family gathering, and we were watching the news, and this was like Christmas Eve, or maybe it was Boxing Day. Yeah, it was December 26th, I think. It was Boxing Day, and we were watching this, and it was unbelievable. The scale of destruction was incredible. And we went to dinner later on that night, and it was a very, very somber mood because, you know, there were thousands upon thousands of people dead already, and nobody knew what the death toll was. And because we were at a seaside resort, you could actually see the sea level rise up dramatically. It was way higher than any of us expected to see. It was a very, very ominous sign. And it was a really, really stark and sober reminder of just how fleeting life can be. But nobody could have possibly predicted that. And it was really a genuinely startling event, a genuinely scary thing to watch, but it wasn't really much we could do about it. COVID-19 is a much less severe event. It's a much, it's probably a higher frequency event, but it's much less severe. Is there anything that the world could have done to prevent it? Well, yes, actually. The primary lesson of that was don't outsource your manufacturing base. And I think that's going to become very clear over the coming weeks and months, where people are going to realize that doing this was a really dumb idea. So I think one of the primary benefits of something like COVID-19 will be a re a renewed appreciation in preventive measures such as maintaining a proper medical and emergency manufacturing base within the confines of one's home country. The Russians have not forgotten this lesson, by the way. They understand it. Their Chinese counterparts probably don't. India understands it because India has a huge pharmaceuticals industry, but the Indian pharmaceutical industry is running out of raw materials because the raw materials come from China. I think the rest of the world is going to cotton on to this pretty quickly. I mean, the God Emperor has already instituted a number of orders which put the focus back on, ensuring that the United States does not run out of crucial medicines when they need them. So, that's really all I had to add about COVID-19. I want to make it clear that this is not something to panic about, so please do not feel that you need to worry too much about that. Please take whatever security measures, preventive measures, hygienic measures that you feel are necessary, and please stay safe, but don't panic, okay? We've been through worse. People like me who are really deep introverts are actually really delighted at the prospect of being told, you know what, just stay indoors for a couple of weeks. Okay, that means I can read, I can surf the web, I can catch up on my, you know, huge long reading list. I can just sit and watch Netflix. I can cook for myself. I can do whatever the hell I want. I don't have to go around and be around people. For a deep introvert, this is fantastic news. I mean, that's exactly what Vox Dei said. You know, people like him and me, who are the types who would just prefer to retire in solitude to a monastery and just buy classic first editions of books, are going to be very happy about this. It's a blessing in disguise. So don't look at it as a reason to panic. Look at it as an opportunity. Look at it as a test. Look at it as a way to find what you want to do for a couple of weeks if it comes to the point where you have to be quarantined or avoid public spaces for a while. React, adapt, overcome. It's not just a military motto. This is a philosophy for life, and this is a good chance to put it into practice. So, with that in mind, I shall bid you adieu. Please like and subscribe if you have not already subscribed to the blog and to the podcast. Please leave your thoughts in the comments section, either here or at the blog. And I will see you on the next one. Stay safe, stay secure, stay healthy, and good luck to all of you.